At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Well, I bet you didn't expect this over the weekend as we're beginning another week here. The yogurt shop murders solved. So we're going to dig into this today. If you're unfamiliar with the case, we're going to familiarize you with it and the latest developments of what took place. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, is going to join us in just a few moments. And we're going to go through what happened here and how we got to the place today and how there were four people, in addition to the four murdered children whose lives were essentially destroyed and ruined in the last 34 years. After 34 years, the infamous yogurt shop murders in Austin are now officially solved. The answer came not from a new witness, not from a last-minute confession, but from science. Advanced DNA testing and genetic genealogy, IGG, as you've heard it talked about in so many cases. They've identified Robert Eugene Brashears as the killer. He was a traveling serial predator back in the 90s, already linked to other murders across the country. He died by suicide back in 1999. Took modern technology to finally close the circle on a case that had haunted Austin for decades. But the real story isn't just who did it. It's what happened along the way. Four innocent young men were dragged through years of suspicion, false confessions, even wrongful convictions, even one ending up on death row because of interrogation tactics and tunnel vision that collapsed under the weight of better evidence. Families lived in limbo, reputations were destroyed, and trust in the system was shaken. So in this conversation, we're not retracing the crime. We're examining what the case teaches us. Robin Dreek, let's start breaking this down and how modern DNA changed the game, why investigators once saw it so wrong, and how bad interview techniques create false confidence, and most importantly, what reforms can make sure another community doesn't wait three decades for the truth. This weekend, I was in my kitchen cooking. I was making pasta sauce. And you texted me going, hey, look, they caught him. And again, I was not expecting that. But again, IGG, it's that DNA. Everybody putting their stuff in the ancestry and the 23andMe and all that. This led to another conviction. Are you surprised?
Yeah, I am surprised, but relieved and traumatized by it, gang, because what... You know, when we looked at this a number of weeks ago, when you had mentioned it to me, so we're watching a series on HBO Max, and it's, like you said, it's rather long series. And I remember when I first pulled up the series to look at it, because this goes to that answer, as you know, I get these long narrative answers. The most striking thing to me was were the cops involved in it back then, where they are now. And how destroyed their lives are now. I mean, you look at the one, these guys look like they're having a hard time recovering from living a very hard life. And I really think this case sent them down a path of that. A lot of pressure on them, on the community to solve this crime because of the horrendous nature of it. It was so traumatic. Four girls killed inside a yogurt shop. No leads, behavioral analysis, zero there because all the things were burned up. So the behavior team came in and gave really nothing. And so then they go down this path of trying to make something happen. And thereby you get a really off interviewer, which is able to compel someone to confess to something and people that the things they didn't do by interjecting false memories, new memories, trauma. I mean, all these things were at play here. And at the end, what happened? Like you said, DNA exonerated everyone, even though they were all exonerated after that, after some time in jail, on death row, and the families. I'm just, this is just a path of destruction because you had one serial killer that was transient. How do you catch that? I mean, it was just, this is the perfect storm of horrible that I've ever seen in such a long time.
And that's a good question. How do you catch that? And at some point, I mean, obviously it's much easier to look back at this 30 years later and go, well, here's all the things you could have done differently. But in 1991, it was very different. Just as I'm sure they'll look back today, maybe at some point, and say, well, the way you're doing things, we found better ways to do them. At least I hope they do, because that's growth. But if we look back at that point in time, I want to walk all the way back to the techniques as to what they were using. They wanted to find somebody. The community wanted, they wanted a villain. They wanted the monster that killed these girls. And of course they did. But there also needs to be the strength on the part of law enforcement, or there needed to be the strength on the part of law enforcement saying, if we don't have him, we don't have him. We can't make one up if it's not him. And I don't know when you look at it full picture that they were consciously trying to make someone up or to create the boogeyman, but they sure found a way of getting false confessions. And I want to dive into all of that. Before we even do that, I think it'd be good for everybody to kind of to get a taste as to what these interrogations looked like, because I want to talk about all of that with you, how this interrogating people has changed, why they thought this was a good idea at one point in time, and where we are today. Todd, let's roll that the clip. This is about 3 minutes, and this is kind of a greatest hits, if you will, of some of the interrogations that were taking place back in the early 90s with those the suspects in the yogurt shop murders. Let's take a look.
We want the truth, but you know what the truth is. You haven't resolved with the memories or flashbacks. You know what happened. You're scared to tell us. I don't blame you. It's a horrible thing what you saw in there.
Look, can I tell y'all what I keep seeing in my head? Tell us what you've seen in your head. I keep seeing these girls get shot.
Right.
Tell us what that looks like. Tell me when you see it specifically. How they're getting shot and who's shooting them. Come on, I've been doing this. Tell it. What tune is today? What video?
Seeing the girl. I remember seeing them down. I remember one girl screaming, terrifying.
Okay.
I don't know if this is real or not, or if this is Michael is real.
It's okay. You can present it to me any way you want. It's real.
Mike, look at me. You're remembering what happened.
See, you're inside there, right?
I don't.
You're remembering what happened.
I don't obviously remember going in the building.
If you were in the building,
you went in there with me.
I don't believe that, Michael. You don't have to know what I'm here.
And you know you were in there.
Did you shoot anything real?
No, sir.
Then tell us what the f- happened. What did those two boys do to those girls? You want to live with this the rest of your life?
No, I don't.
Then get it out right now. They're f***ing you over. They're the ones that shot the girls. Do it. What did you see happen?
At some point, Maurice handed his that revolver. What did he say to you?
Either shoot him or you're next.
That's what he
said. Because I didn't want to do it.
Right. Either shoot him or you're next. What do you remember hearing then?
I remember looking at this girl. I cry. I hear Robert saying, do it, do it. I hear the gun go off. I only pulled the trigger once. I turned around. Here's your stupid gun.
What happens next, Mike? That brought back some memories, didn't it? I remember looking at the gun. You ever seen that gun before? I'm not positive. Does that look like a gun you've seen before?
It looks like the gun I've seen before, but I'm not positive.
Is that the gun you shot somebody with, Mike?
I don't.
Is that the gun you walked up behind somebody with and shot the head? Is that the one? Talk to me, Mike.
Yes.
You did that, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
We've just opened some more doors, haven't we, Mike?
Not really.
You sure?
Yes, sir.
So that's some of the police interrogation techniques that were used back in 1999 on some of these kids. Robin, what's your reaction when you see how that went down? What are you seeing?
So it's interesting. I've seen that those tactics before pretty frequently, actually, because there's a lot of leading questions. I mean, you're an interviewer, you know that. There's a lot of leading questions there. And there's a lot of presumed knowledge on the behalf of the cops. But here's where, as I was really thinking about this as I'm watching this, because what they're doing is not necessarily off of what they've been trained to do and what you do when you're getting confession. But here's where there's a huge disconnect, a massive disconnect. You typically use a very confrontational way after you have, and you've used what's called rationalizations, projections, and minimizers, RPMs. You help them rationalize their behavior. You project the blame onto others, like you're a victim of the circumstance around you, and minimize it. Hey, you only killed two girls. It could have been much worse. Could have killed five. Four girls. See what I mean? Yeah. So those are the things you do to try to help them walk up to the cliff, as they say, before pushing you over. Because pushing them over that psychological cliff is doing what he's doing right there, where you're very accusatory. You're trying to nail down timelines. But here's where the massive flaw in this is. You only do that when you are actually sure and 100% confident on the things you're saying. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have evidence that they actually did do this. You can actually walk them through the timeline that you've established, and they're now going to admit to what you've already know that had happened. That is typically the way it's done. So what they did was they took a wild-ass guess that they're the ones that did it and how it was and how it happened, and they're now placing it onto them. And the way our memories work, and they did a great job in the series describing our memories work in packets. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is he's using superimposing events. And when you hear something in the news and you hear it on TV or you hear it somewhere else, when you get a time separation from it, you can't remember whether I lived it or didn't. I mean, we do this all the time. I think if you're a visual person in particular, if you read a book and it was a really, really good book, and you tend to be visual, a lot of times you give it some time passage between the time you read the book and like a couple years away from the event, you have a hard time, if it's well written, to remember if you saw it as a movie or read it as a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So it's the same thing here. So these people are going to have known about the case, known about some circumstances of the case, and now this cop is telling them that they were part of it, and he's leading them down the path of creating the linkages. He was very effective at I've never seen a more effective way to get a false confession. But it was flawed because he didn't know it was them. And he's getting them, and he's placing false memories, doing linkages between these packets, and they're separated by time, as we've seen in many other cases. And it's a disaster.
I mean, it's very interesting to watch. And we go back to 1999. Was this being trained? I mean, was this what they were being trained to do? Were they doing the best they could, I guess, is my question. At that moment in time, was this the way that they believed would be the most effective to getting an accurate confession out of people? And have we since learned differently since? Or were they already behind the times and this is just how they were doing it back then here in Austin?
So the fact that I've seen this done says that it's not a wrong technique if you know that they've done the crime and you're trying. Granted, there's just a lot.
They're not using it correctly.
Yeah, and here's the other thing too. So the other thing that struck me about this was the fact that they're using a very empathetic methodology, meaning that they're relying on the fact that this person that they're interviewing and interrogating has empathy towards their victims, has empathy towards other human beings. They're playing on their emotional response to these things. And the problem here is if you have someone that just killed four people, they're most likely high psychopathy. They're not going to respond to those techniques. And so it's going to be very accusatory on here's the facts we have. So it's an emotional way to compel someone to admit something they didn't do. If you're dealing with someone who actually just murdered someone or is being accused of someone, and you actually have the facts and data, you're going to lead them down the path where they incriminate themselves more effectively, like saying, hey, listen, you say you didn't do it. All right, so help me understand this. Now you lay about a piece of evidence. Tell me this. Mm-hmm. All right, then tell me how come your fingerprint was on this. If this was what you say you were on this certain date and time, then how come I have this? You know, so that's where you kind of confront them with their lies once you got them over that edge. And so you're going through the process of facts and data with having them try to explain away through more elaborate lies. And that's when it all falls apart. And that's when you say, listen, we can do it an easy way and a hard way, not for me, but for you. You know, here's what sentences are in typical cases like this. You're looking at life, looking at death, or we can make myself an advocate for you and bring some resolution to these families if that's something that means something to you. But if you want to just fry, we can go that way. So you tell me what path you want to go down. And so that's when you kind of lead them up to the edge. Here's what I got. I got more. We can keep going down where there's inconsistency between what you say and what evidence I have, or you can just share with me your story, get your story out there, because what really matters is not what I think. What matters is what happened according to you. So let's do this together. So that's how, see how I did that? It's a lot different than saying, bop, 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 bop.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're using facts and data.
I have a question, Robin, and I don't want to derail the conversation in any way, but this is going to get a little personal. As a parent, have you used these tactics on your kids? Because as teens, they push things. So I'm curious, because I'm sitting here, I'm thinking back to times when I did something naughty as a teen and my mom knew I did it.
Right.
And I was being led down that path. Like, she knows, I can tell she knows, and she's heading in that direction. Did you ever use these immense skills of interrogation on your kids?
So I rule,
I mean, come on, other people have to be asking this too.
Robin has a little room in his house with just a light hanging from it and a table. And his kids, it's like, it's time to come into the daddy room. We're going to talk.
So there's a philosophy of life that I live when I was working and in everything I do. And that is, how do you inspire someone to tell the truth before they have an opportunity to lie? And so that's what elicitation is. And so you can leak out, hey, here's some facts and data. I know you, and I know you really well. I know you don't want to do something that's going to hurt you, and definitely don't want to hurt our relationship. Here's a great opportunity, without judgment, of helping me understand, because you normally make a lot of really great, healthy decisions. This looks like a situation that might have deviated from that. Help me understand what led you up to make this choice and decision, so we can kind of work on this together, if that's something you're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So that's how I typically engage. But when my kids were really young, here's what I did. It was the most effective thing ever. I told my kids, I said, hey, dad works for the FBI and I'm a behavior guy. And here's a special technique I have. I can tell if someone's been lying or not if they stick out their tongue. And I'd say to my kids, I said, Kevin, let me see your tongue. And she went like this. I said, aha, you're going to lie. I said, don't lie to me, Kevin. I can tell.
I like it.
I love that. Thank you for answering that. Because this entire time I'm like, I can't imagine using these skills in your real life. Not that you'd have to, but, you know, who took the last cookie and the kids got crumbs on their mouth going, I didn't do it. You've got skills, man.
So it's about never judging the choices they make. And that's what I did in my job. And it's what I do in life. I do that in everything with each other. I mean, it's like understanding the context, walk a mile in someone else's shoes to see what decisions you would make. And so what I did with my kids and I do with everyone is help me understand, walk me in your shoes and I'll take mine off to put yours on and let's go down this path together. And then once I start understanding without judging the choices you made, then we can start making some choices together on the best path forward. And I can play forward from my experience for you, the cause and effect your actions that you took, and we can try to mitigate them together the best way we can possibly can. Now, granted, that methodology I just laid out for how we inspire someone to share information it might not be in their best interest to share, that's what I call confession, works with people that are empathetic, that are not outside that are not super outside of parameters of normal behavior. This works with people that was a crime of passion, that was a moment of losing control of, and they generally have a slightly more ability for regulation. So here's what that wouldn't work with. Koberger, pure psychopath. Those words mean nothing. They roll right off. The only thing that works with someone that's edging up more on psychopathy is that grandiosity. Is like, listen, kind of like Olivia Consalves did with him. It's like, you kind of suck. Matter of fact, you just don't kind of suck. You definitely suck. You're the worst thing I ever saw. You said you wanted to be this great individual. I'll tell you what, you got one opportunity to kind of prove to me that you are as great as you think you are. Tell me how you're better than, and then you rattle off all the people he idolized. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do it, then you know what? You're just another punk and you sucked at everything you did.
Yeah.
Wholly different tactic on, because that's the only thing that resonates with psychopathy is grandiosity. And so they're kind of, and so I give it to the cops, maybe, I don't know if they thought this hard about it. They're dealing with the people they are interviewing. These were not psychopaths. They were using an empathetic approach to interviewing and interrogating. But if someone killed four kids, it wouldn't match. See what I mean? There's an incongruence between who they're talking to and the methodology and techniques. But so now to get to your original question, training. There's not a lot of training. You think that, you know, people that are in law enforcement go through the most advanced training and techniques there are in the world, but really the best training there is you're introduced to a baseline of how to talk to a human being, whether it's a read technique for interviewing, and we talked at length about this in the last couple weeks, the Socratic method about how to interview someone by asking a lot of questions, discovery questions, as we call. But the only way you really get good at it is doing it a lot, then reflecting on what was a good, what wasn't effective, what was more effective, doing it with a partner so the partner can debrief you as well. Because when you're going to be a really good interviewer and a really good interrogator and getting someone to inspire them to share something that's not in their best interest, the last thing you do is show them their shame. And the first thing you do is you have to be able to meet them where they are at their tempo, at their thing. And then you have to be able to match it to your own personality, your own delivery style about how you present yourself. As very individualistic. You only get good at it when you do it. How does someone become a master? Was it 10,000 hours, 10,000 reps? And so to throw someone in there and they've only done something. So here's the other thing too. If you've only done something one way your entire career, the likelihood of your flexibility to do it another way is slim to none. Mm-hmm. If you've only done this type of interview and interrogation once or if never in your career, what's the likelihood you're going to be good at it? Slim to none. Yeah. So all those things play in. I'm sorry, long answer as always.
No. I think one of the biggest questions that people have about false confessions, especially when it comes to something like this, is how does someone give it? Michael Scott gave it. Not Michael Scott from The Office. Literally, the guy's name is Michael Scott. He was pressured into giving up Robert Springsteen, that he was part of it, and then the two of them were convicted together. All on things that never took place.
I know.
Was he convinced when they were going through this process? Was Michael Scott literally believing that he did not remember these things and they were coming back to him in this police interrogation? Or was it as simple as the explanations that are thrown out there? Well, they were tired. They were exhausted. They just wanted to get out of there. I don't know that I would, again, I've never been in this situation, but I don't know that I would ever be confessing to a murder just to get away from more questions. You look at like the Richard Allen interview. He never, ever confessed to it until he was literally, mentally broken as a human being after more than a year of being sitting in a solitary confinement chamber being tortured. These are kids in a police interrogation for quite some time. I mean, many, many hours, but that's quite a thing to give up and quite a thing to say. Keep in mind, it's a young mind too. These are teenagers at this moment.
Yeah.
So, a little, I guess, more meldable, but I guess that's the big question. My long question is, how and why did they ever get to the point of saying that they did this if they didn't do it? And clearly they didn't do it. Right. So how did they get there?
So I had to do a lot of research on this too, because I don't deal in the world where you get a lot of false confessions. Mm-hmm. And we saw it with the Richard Allen case, and he was very clearly, to me, the isolation aspect, and that goes to the stress and exhaustion. Totally, that plays into it. So, like you're saying, the teenagers here, not necessarily in that realm. I think the playing on the guilt most likely was an aspect of the skin. This is wholly guessing because we don't know. As I've tried to do a deeper research on these four individuals the life afterwards, and they're wrecked people. And I think they might have been going down a path back then of that as well, because one of the things that makes you more susceptible is, I think, age, because before the prefrontal lobe's fully formed up to like 23, 24, your impressibility is very, very high. And when you have a person of an authority figure, you know, impressing on you what happened and from their context, and they're explaining away your memory issues. I've seen this before with counselors. I've known counselors that were dealing with people's trauma, telling them that one of the reasons they have trauma is because they have an issue with their mother, because their mother must have sexually abused them growing up. And I've seen counselors tell people that you don't remember it because it's so traumatic. And so now this person now believes they were sexually abused by their mother. Completely fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and that's what this guy is doing here. He's taking memory gaps, or not even memory gaps, a lack of a memory, and explaining it away to them in a position of authority so that now it becomes a new memory. He's taken a small segment of, you've seen a gun, you've seen this gun before, but you've seen a gun like this. Well, you've seen a gun like this. It must have been this gun. So he's leading them down a path of creating a new memory. It's
does the interviewer know that that's what he's doing at that moment in time in this case? I mean, I get, like, if you were to use this for nefarious purposes and look back on it going, oh, well, here's how you could elicit that. But I'm wondering, at the point in time, these investigators, these interviewers that are doing this, obviously they want to get to the bottom of this. I can't in my heart believe that they're trying to make these kids make things up. I think they genuinely think they're getting legitimate answers.
Yeah. So their methodology of hunting for someone back then, especially, I mean, think about this now, the likelihood of something like this happening now is so much less, because what they didn't have in this investigation was Ring cameras. They didn't have cell phones to triangulate and be able to say how many people were actually in that shop that night, be able to get cell phone data. There's DNA. There's so many things that they didn't have. All they had was interviews, and their only methodology they had in this small town was, who looks odd? Really, that's what that did. They brought in people that looked odd, that didn't fit that norm of behavior, what they thought normal, healthy people would do. So they only interviewed people that were unhealthy people and people that stood out from a norm. And so that became, it must be one of them. Mm-hmm. And so if we started getting a little inkling of what we think it is, in other words, they did really, really no science of profiling, because the profilers didn't give anything on this, because they said all the evidence was destroyed because of the fire. Mm-hmm. So they're coming up with their own conjecture on who they thought it was. It must be someone odd. So they created a filter of only odd people and only odd people. So let's think about this. Odd people, when you're looking at a societal norm for a region, there's going to be some, I'm not saying mental health issues, but there's going to be some issues of not feeling like you fit in, not feeling connected, and maybe mental issues as well. And so their brains might be a little more susceptible. So this guy's all playing on this. Now, do I think he's sitting there and saying, I'm going to get a false confession? No.
Mm-hmm.
But he's going to grab on to what he thinks is someone's got leakage on the fact that they did it. And his only use and his only evidence is the fact that they're different from this societal norm in our culture right here.
And this is 1991. This is Austin, Texas. This is, I mean, and I will say, if you weren't alive in 1991, people, odd folks stood out more. I don't know any other way to say it. Odd stood out. We live in a culture where everybody can kind of be who they are, I mean, in many ways, far more than they could in 1991. I'll put it that way.
And you wouldn't give it a second glance.
Yes. And so you have a lot of folks where it's like, well, this is odd, because everybody's kind of in their own smaller tribes, I would say, than they were in 1991. So the kids from the wrong side of the tracks that look a little spooky did stand out a bit more, you know, than they, I guess, would have today. So it was easier to point the finger and go, well, you look different, so you're spooky. You must have something nefarious going on, because you listen to the hard rock and you wear the heavy metal t-shirts. It was satanic panic time. All that stuff was going on. So a very understanding the mindset, it was very different back then as well. But of course, like, not everybody who looks a little different is out for nefarious intent. In fact, most of the time they're not. So it was a very different place in time than what we have today, in terms of folks like that standing out. And then I would guess, you know, also preconceived notions on, well, they must be up to no good. I would imagine that all played into this as well.
You look different. We're a very judgy society at that time frame, and four girls are dead. It must be you. And I just got to figure out how to get you to confess to it.
And how, let me ask you this. How confusing is it for an investigator when you do get the false confession? They weren't very versed in psychology at all on how any of this worked. They were there to get them to say the words, I did it.
Right.
And when they eventually do get someone saying, I did it, if you think that you got it through legitimate means and you're completely unaware that it's not, you're going to Why would this person say this if it's not true? Maybe I did find the person, even though I kind of led them down this road. Then you have that in the back of your mind going, well, I did get them to say it. So why would they say it? I wouldn't say it if I was doing it. Then you get that, their own storyline trying to play against someone else's storyline of confessing or not confessing. So it's confusion all around, I think, for a lot of people, including the investigators.
So they all got caught up in the culture of wanting to solve this and not being investigators, not exploring all the inconsistencies. Because every time you have an inconsistency, that's something you need to explore. Mm-hmm. And so if you, what typically happens in cases like this, in any case, is all right, so you're willing to confess. All right, now you got to write it out. Mm-hmm. And the first time they try to write out their confession and you then have everyone that they say was involved write out their confession, isolated from each other, all of them are going to be different.
Yeah.
Because it's not a real memory. And so right there as an investigator, as a prosecutor, all right, so say you're an investigator. Investigators are really at the granular level. They're very close to the case. They have their own confirmation biases, and that's why we have co-case agents. That's why we have supervisors. And more importantly, that's why we have prosecutors that know what's going to be admissible in court and what it's going to look like to a jury. And when you actually have confessions, all right, we got confessions, and you have four of them that are – like a shotgun spread, that as a prosecutor saying, yeah, we need to go back and look at this some more. But this wasn't happening because then you have the societal pressure to solve the case. You have you have crying parents. You have a community that's afraid that there's a killer still out there. You have all the external factors that are driving this, which makes it the perfect storm. And all because this guy, from what I think, in this time period was uncatchable. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the stats of unresolved crimes and murders, it's just be another one. And there's, what is it? Like I looked up all these stats, you know, I do. It's like 3,000 or 4,000 murders a year are unsolved.
Yeah. And there was no IGG back then. There was
this
no
guy it's called a hybrid serial killer, you know, half planned, half impulsive. And he was transient. Like you said, how the hell do you catch, you know, because they kept looking. I mean, the fatal flaw in this was they're looking at, and it's not because they were fatally flawed, just because there's nothing else to do. They're looking at their own community. Mm-hmm. He wasn't there. He was out in and out in a blink of an eye. This was a target of opportunity because how did this guy target people? From now that we know who it was, he targeted women that were isolated, that were standing alone, that, you know, was good skin. Predators don't go for hard targets. They don't, you know, that's why they hit churches. That's why they hit females late at night, isolated in yogurt shops where no one is, you know, strip malls that are about to close up. You know, they don't go for the hard targets where everyone's going to see them. They go for the soft, and that's what this guy was doing. He's transient. He's moving across the Southeast and the South, and he's hitting what he's considering from his soft, easy targets. How do you catch that?
Especially at that point in time, the technology wasn't there to do it. And there's, you know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of unsolved murders that are still out there that are slowly coming to the surface because of IGG. I mean, look at the Golden State Killer and things of that nature that were all caught, you know, using that sort of technology.
Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, if it hadn't been for the brother recognizing the handwriting, the Unabomber, which, well, he'd probably be dead by now anyway. But I mean, the path of destruction would continue because there's someone actually was able to hide, and because he didn't do it for ego. Well, I'm sorry, we'll get a whole different thing. He knew how to hide is a better way to put it, because he was a planned and calculated individual that left no digital or any kind of forensic footprint. And how did he do it? He had to dive under rocks or live in a shack in a cabin in the middle of nowhere and have zero interaction with the outside world. That's the only way.
Yeah. And he didn't worry about, well, I got to turn my cell phone off. He didn't need the cell phone.
Nope,
he was doing it the real way of being out there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.